It's my custom at the first talk of the year to be on the Four Noble Truths as one of the foundation pieces for Buddhist practice. So that's what it'll be today. And I'll start with a story of once upon a time. There was a monastery that had the custom that at the beginning of the year, the abbot would call together the newest of the monks who'd only been in the monastery for less than a year, and say, please get ready and pack your bags, because I'm going to take you on a pilgrimage to the holy sites of the Buddha, the places that are holy in Buddhism. And traditionally, that's the places of the Buddha was born, where he was enlightened, where he lived, where he died. So the abbot says, I'm going to take you on a pilgrimage to the holy sites. So these new monks were quite excited. It was a big chance. And so they packed their bags, and the day came for their journey, and they took off. And first, the abbot took them to a hospital where people were sick, and they toured the wards, Laguna Honda. And then next they went to an old age home and saw all the old people there. Went to Laguna Honda and to Hopkins Manor is next door. And then finally he took them to a hospice and a crematorium. Saw people dying, dead, being cremated. And then he took them back to the monastery. And he chose to come back to the monastery at a time when all the monks were meditating. Came into the meditation hall, and the first thing they saw was the stillness and the quiet of a hall full of meditators, very engaged, very still, very poised, practicing. And that was the pilgrimage to the four holy sites. And so the monks were a little bit surprised by this. They were expecting some long trip to India. But I think because of the surprise, it really made a big impact on them. There's something holy, sacred, very special about the encounter of sickness, old age, and death. And then once you've encountered that, there's something very special about engaging and contacting someone who is on a path of practice. And I think that all religions, most religions, attempt or address deep existential issues that we as human beings have. And there's a variety of solutions that different religions try to have to the questions of sickness, old age, and death, especially to death. You know, what happens when we die? What happens after we're dead? And many people would like to have great reassurance that once they die, that's not it, that somehow there's a glorious future after death. And some people will choose religions based on how the kind of teachings they have around what happens after death. It just seems right, or seems most inspired, or has the most promise. And one of the characteristics of Buddhism is not to look for a solution to life's difficulties in the future. Not to look for, after death, for example. You get to go to heaven and there everything will be great, or you get to go to the promised land or something. There's no attempt to delay the resolution of the issues that come up around sickness, old age, and death. But there is an attempt to really grapple very honestly with the issues of represented by sickness, old age, and death, with the core existential issues we have. And the idea that being all the other kind of issues, difficulties, and complexities that people have in their lives are kind of pale in significance next to the issues of sickness, old age, and death. But they all come under the rubric of sickness, old age, and death. And so Buddhism, then it's an attempt to address this very directly. And then the Buddhists like this image of a lotus growing out of muddy water. And the mud, where this kind of lotus seed, I guess, gets planted in mud. the swamp or whatever, is like the mud of life. The difficulty, the complexity, the suffering, the sickness, old age, kind of the stuff of life that people often want to get out of. But that's where it starts. You have to plant the seed in the mud. And then the lotus grows up out of the mud, but connected to the mud. And then at some point blossoms, this beautiful lotus blossom that comes up out of the top of the water. And then it's said that the lotus blossom is unstained by the muddy waters. So somehow there's an awakening, there's a blossoming of the heart, the blossoming of the mind, an awakening that arises up out of the mud, but is connected to the mud as the mind becomes illuminated or awakened or freed. And so that's kind of like the movement, is that a movement into the mud to really address it and see it, understand it, and then coming up out of that, there's this blossoming. So not avoiding it, but entering into it. And the analogy I like for this is, if you've ever tried, probably all of you have tried jumping at some point or other in your life. And if you try first, before you jump, to stand on your tippy toes and with your knees straight, and then try to jump, you don't go very far. But if you want to really jump well, you usually have to crouch down first, and then you can spring up. It's kind of spring action, right? So first you have to kind of bend down. So it's kind of like that. If you want to kind of become, you know, liberated, you have to first get into it, kind of crouch down, really kind of get into the mud, I guess, and really get to know it well, so that you can have that support to spring up or to leap free So the Four Noble Truths are the key or the central description the Buddha had for the path of liberation, or the practice of liberation, the context of liberation. And it begins with getting into the mud. It begins with this crouching down into the stuff of our life. And that's counterintuitive for most of us, because it's mostly, most intuitive is to keep the difficulties away. I'm trying to get away from my difficulties as fast as I can. The stresses of my life, the worries, the anxieties, the pain, the despair, the whatever it might be, you know. But here, in the First Noble Truth, the instruction is to really go in there and get to know it well. Really kind of crouch down in the mud. Feel it. And because the First Noble Truth is a truth of suffering, which is the truth that says that in human life there will be, there is suffering. And the practice around suffering of our life is to get to know it really well. That's the practice. That's the first step. Just get to know it well. And so there's a variety of different kinds of suffering. The Buddha, when he enumerated the kinds of the sufferings that he was addressing in the First Noble Truth, he said, birth is suffering, sickness is suffering, old age is suffering, death is suffering, being separated from what you love is suffering, being connected to what you dislike is suffering, and the entire world of grasping, our psychophysical world of grasping, all of it is suffering. So this is kind of like the bad news of Buddhism, right, that no one wants to hear. You know, some of you are already wondering, you know, why did I come today? Mud, crouching in the mud, and suffering, all this kind of stuff. But that's kind of, that's meant to be the beginning. The second noble truth is a discussion about the conditions or the cause that gives a rise to this suffering. It's a little bit of a tautology in philosophy, where two things define each other. So, you know, so the suffering that's being discussed in the First Noble Truth is that suffering that's given birth from, or arises from, the Second Noble Truth. So the Second Noble Truth says that the cause of suffering, or this kind of suffering, is thirst, or grasping, or clinging, or drivenness, or compulsion. So they're kind of thirsting, kind of powerful compulsion. And if you think of it as compulsion, then you can kind of think that when there's compulsivity going on in the mind, it's hard to put something down. And if something's not serving you well, if something's bringing you suffering, and you say, well, that's enough, I'd like to stop that. If your mind is compulsive, it's hard to put it down, and the suffering persists. And probably some of you have wondered why you can't seem to be freed from so easily from some of the things that bother you. Your suffering, your despair, or sadness, or depression, or fear, or anger, or hostility, there's all kinds of things that exist there that kind of follow us and can weigh us down. And it'd be nice to snap our fingers and just say, it'd be nice to, for it to finish. But it doesn't go away so quickly, it kind of stays there. And the suggestion in Buddhism is that it stays there because there's certain momentum in the mind of drivenness, of compulsion, that has its own momentum. And so we can't just kind of, out of choice, just drop it so easily. But we have to address it, we have to look at it. Now when the Buddha described the second noble truth, he described it by saying there are three kinds of thirsting, three kinds of compulsivity. The first is the thirst for sensual desire. And none of you, of course, are troubled by sensual desire. But it is, if you read the newspapers, or just, you don't have to go very far to see that this is this is a huge issue for most human beings. And sensual desire includes a whole range of desires. Maybe first and foremost that some people think about is sexual desire. But there's also the desire for a variety of different kinds of pleasure. Addiction are often originating from sensual desire. Desire for pleasure. Confusing pleasure for happiness. And then pursuing the alcohol or drugs. Sometimes there's a compulsivity around the pleasure of food, and people eat a lot. Or there's a whole variety of things that people can be addicted to in terms of being a pleasure, being comfortable. And the suggestion in Buddhism, the idea in Buddhism is this is a very deeply seated source of compulsivity, and that compulsivity can cause a lot of suffering, a lot of damage, a lot of pain. Probably a good percentage of you have caused suffering, either to yourself or to others, by some attachment, some acting on an addiction to sensual pleasure. Then the next two are quite interesting. There's a list of three forms of craving given here. And the next two give you the sense that I think better to understand them as being deeply rooted forms of craving, or the roots of craving, the common denominators. There's many kinds of craving that people have, and some of them are kind of like the leaves on a tree. You can take off the leaves, but the tree just sprouts new leaves. But if you want to kind of somehow do away with the weedy tree, you have to uproot it. You have to take the roots out, take it out by the roots. So some of these thirsts, drivenness, are deeply rooted, and you have to kind of get down into the root in order to do the uprooting. So the second and third forms of thirsting is a desire for existence and the desire for non-existence. Those are kind of technical words. And the desire for existence includes things like the desire, the drive to have an identity, to hold yourself, this is who I am, to the drive to accomplish something, to make something happen, the drive to procreate, to have children, to create children, for example, to be a father or mother. There's a whole bunch of things that have to do with becoming and creating and making something, bringing something into existence. Now, there's nothing wrong with that in and of itself, but I think we have to admit that the drive, the compulsive drive, to have something exist is something that caused people a lot of suffering. The drive to exist as a certain identity can cause a lot of suffering. I've suffered around that, where thinking I had to be a certain way, and so I try to fit myself into that box and kind of, shape myself in a certain way in order to maintain a certain identity. Or I have had an identity that I thought was just who I really was, thank you, but it seemed like reality didn't didn't cooperate that well, and so I would try to kind of build it up, you know, hold on to it or something. You know, so for example, the identity of being a young person. You know, some people are young, some people here are young, and some people are, you know, some people here, you know, their youth is, you know, it doesn't have many days left. It's still here. And so people hold on sometimes to the identity of their youth and all that the youth means. And it can cause a lot of suffering and be a huge expense for some people. You know, or the identity of status or profession or all kinds of roles that people identify with, and they can cause a lot of suffering. There's a lot of suffering around having children. I've known people who have wanted children desperately, and somehow it wasn't happening, for a variety of reasons. And it's a tremendous source of suffering in that. And that suffering kind of carries with them sometimes the rest of their life. You know, they wish they would have had children. And so there's a suffering there. The Buddha talked about suffering. Here's a form of suffering that arises out of that desire for a certain kind of existence, bringing something into life. Perhaps a desire for accomplishments, sometimes a desire to do, to make. There's nothing wrong with that, but there can be a drivenness that behind it, that when that drivenness is frustrated, that our psyche can suffer a lot of frustration. The third kind of thirsting is the thirsting for non-existence. And this is a kind of an aversion, kind of pushing things away, making sure that something doesn't exist. Some people have an attachment to not existing as an identity. They don't want to. They don't want to be someone. They want to be invisible, or anytime they stand up and or anything that's going to define them, they want to knock down any kind of definition. Don't see me that way. I don't want to be seen that way. Some people don't want to have anything come their way. They're oppressed by what life comes, and they just want everything to go away. Go away, go away. I want to be simpler. I want to be left alone. I don't want things. In the extreme form of desire, thirsting for non-existence, it can be the desire for suicide. And I don't want to exist at all. Just stop. So both the desire for existence and desire for non-existence can be seen as being very, very deeply embedded in the human being. And they play out in both mild ways, simple, almost innocent ways, and they play out in very deep-seated ways. They can seem so innate and so connected to what it means to be a human being that it can seem impossible to uproot them. Or it can seem like it's a kind of violence to who we are as human being to uproot them. There can be a very disorienting, the idea, I need these things. How can I exist without these kinds of desires? Or the desire can be so strong that what comes along with it is an unwillingness to entertain the alternative, to entertain the idea that it might be possible not to live in the grasp of these kinds of desires. It's unimaginable that human life is worthwhile without having some of these desires fulfilled. And if you suggest that it's, you know, an alternative is possible, people might get angry. Or they might take the great, Augustine who said, give me chastity, but later? So, you know, yes, you know, I will overcome these great desires, but later. After I've had my chance to, you know, to fulfill them all. And so, in talking about the second noble truth, saying that the origin of suffering is in thirst, the Buddha, I believe, is pointing at something very, very so deep in our human being that it can seem unacceptable, it can seem impossible that it's worthwhile or appropriate to uproot these things. Then the third noble truth is the truth of the cessation of this thirst and the cessation of suffering. So this is the good news. this is when you start doing the leap out of the mud, you know, or the flowers blossoming. And this is when you've understood your suffering well, have respected it, engaged in it in a proper way, and then understood the craving that gives birth to that. And then in a variety of ways have learned to let go or to soften, to release that craving. And that release is called in Buddhism cessation, the cessation of that suffering, cessation of that craving. It's stating it in a negative way, just the end of something, and you don't get a sense from that statement that it's a glorious thing, you know. But actually, the ending of clinging is a fantastic thing, to have the mind not in conflict, to have the mind at peace, to have the mind not the mind not in the grip of some kind of compulsivity, is a beautiful thing. And some of you probably get a little sense of that, intimation of that, intuition of that, when you meditate. So it's not uncommon for people when they sit down to meditate to be to discover that their mind has a mind of its own, that there's a certain degree of compulsivity, of drivenness in the thinking mind, and it just simply doesn't want to stop and let itself down. And it might at first seem, why should I? It's, you know, the thinking is kind of who I am, and I should just be have unfettered access to think whatever I want, and not only that, but to pursue the dreams that my thoughts are telling me that I need to pursue. But it's possible to kind of get a sense, it's possible to have that thinking mind quiet down and either feel or have an intuition of a sense of peace on the other side of that compulsivity of thinking. And some of you perhaps had a little taste of the calm or peace that that's possible. So when we don't just simply put to rest the surface clinging and graspings of our mind, of our hearts, but are able to get down into the roots of sensual desire, the root of desire for clinging, for existence and non-existence, and uproot those, then there's a kind of a revolution that goes on in the heart and the mind, a kind of a radical transformation to churn. And you'll never understand yourself the same way again. It's kind of like a butterfly never understands itself the same when it becomes, and a butterfly, a worm, doesn't understand itself the same once it gets transformed and becomes a butterfly. It's not the same thing anymore. So there's something very radical that happens when the cessation, the letting go, the release, can get down and happen in this very, very deep fundamental place in our psyche. Then the fourth noble truth is the truth of the path. And this is the recognition that to do this release, to do this cessation, is not an easy task. We can't just snap our fingers and wish it to be so. And in order to do it, we have to kind of engage our whole being, our whole life, our whole sense of who we are. And in order to kind of do the inner work that allows us to get down to those roots, that allows us to really release, let go in a profound way. So this is where it's a spiritual path that's all-encompassing, includes all of who we are. If you're just a weekend Buddhist, then you don't go very far. Or if you're a nightstand Buddhist, you don't go very, very far. Or if you're a wannabe Buddhist, you know, wannabe meditator. And meditation doesn't work. You know, you guys know that? Meditation doesn't work? Unless you do it. So you got to do it. So you have to use, you know, all, and the idea is the path is something all of who you are is included. Now the image that's used for the path is an image of walking. A path is something you walk. And here you see that the Buddhism focuses on you doing the walking. It isn't that you use someone else who can do the walking for you. It isn't that you have this great, wonderful guru, like the Buddha or someone else, who's going to zap you, do a dharma, do a transmission, of mind-to-mind transmission, and then you get it. I just need the right, you know, channel, the right frequency, or I need the right teacher who has the right frequency, and then I don't have to worry about anything anymore, and it should be done for me. And there are some people who have that approach to spiritual life. They're expecting someone else to do it for them if they just get in their presence. Or perhaps it's the gods or God that's going to do it for them. You just have to kind of pray in the right way and something's going to be done to you and for you. Or you're going to hold on to a certain kind of belief. And that belief is going to kind of make you safe and kind of do it for you. The Four Noble Truths are not meant to be beliefs. Rather, they're meant to be a part of the path that you walk, that you engage in. Because the idea of walking in a path is that you are the one who does it. You can't expect someone else to do it for you. You have to do it. So you have to enter into this path. If what you want is liberation, if what you want to be freed from the deep-seated roots of thirst, of suffering. If you're not interested in that, of course, then the path's not needed. You know, there's no religious imperative in Buddhism, thou shalt walk this path, or lightning will strike, or something terrible will happen to you. Nothing terrible will happen to you, except you'll suffer. You'll keep suffering. But if you're interested in this freedom from suffering, then the suggestion is that you want to include all of your life in it. And it's possible to talk about this path, the Eightfold Path, free of Buddhist language. So we don't kind of free ourselves from the idea that this is a Buddhist thing you're encountering and doing. The Four Noble Truths are not meant to make you a Buddhist. They're supposed to be more like, you know, if you go to your dentist and your dentist is a Republican, you know, it's okay. You know, you probably don't care that much. You know, you just want to make sure the teeth get taken care of. You know, you're not being asked to become a Republican by having your, you know, by opening your mouth, or a Democrat or whatever. And but the so this Four Noble Truths thing also, you know, you're not being asked to become a Buddhist, but they're offered as practical tools and insights, understanding. They can help you at times when you might feel you need help in terms of freeing from suffering. So the Eightfold Path is the path we walk. And the path that we walk then begins with the first of the Eightfold Path. And the first of the Eightfold Path is right orientation or right view. And specifically, this means that you begin to understand your suffering through the filter of the Four Noble Truths that you're interested in. That's when you suffer, that you want to understand your suffering according to these kind of little equation. There's suffering, there's a cause of suffering, and there's a possibility of release of suffering. If you don't have that kind of perspective, then there's no hope for you. Oh, I understand I suffer, that I'm not going to do any more work than that. You have to kind of engage with suffering more. You have to understand what the cause is. You have to understand the possibility of the freedom from it and begin experiencing some degree of freedom from that clinging. So the first of the Eightfold Path is to begin understanding our suffering from that point of view. I see it as a way of taking responsibility for how we contribute to our suffering. One of the epidemic illnesses in our culture, maybe in a lot of cultures, is blaming other people for our suffering. And certainly society and the world creates the conditions for suffering. But one of the great challenges of Buddhism to us is that your suffering is something that you contribute to. And if you're interested in the path of the Buddhist path, the Eightfold Path, you have to begin being interested in what your contribution is. It doesn't mean that you turn a blind eye to what other people do. But the path is found by taking responsibility of your contribution to your suffering. That's where it's found. If you're not interested, that's fine, but that's where the path is found. What is my contribution? What's your contribution? And not being quick then to blame or look outside. And then the idea of noble is a great word. The noble truths, the Four Noble Truths. It means that these truths are very highly respected. The word noble can almost be translated as sacred. It's considered sacred. Suffering is not sacred, or suffering is not noble or respected unless it's understood. if it's not understood, there's nothing noble about it. But if you really understand it, understand the nature of it, and understand how it fits into this formula of the Four Noble Truths, then we make it into something that's sacred. Not so that we suffer more and more, but then it becomes part of the path. So then the first of the Eightfold Path is beginning to understand our suffering from this perspective. The second step in the Eightfold Path is doing the best we can to reconfigure or reorient our attitude about how we're going to be in this world and how we're going to walk the path. So again, since the idea is to take responsibility, not only take responsibility for our suffering and our causes of it, but we take some responsibility for our attitude. And to some degree, you can overdo this and do it in an insincere way, but you can do it. It's appropriate to change your attitude if you're going to try in certain activities. So the attitude by which you go bowling, probably have a certain attitude that you bring along. It's very different than the attitude you have if you go spend a day in a kindergarten class. A kindergarten class requires a certain attitude, a certain kind of approach, different kind of attitude than going to a ball game. Different activities we do call for different attitudes. You go to a funeral. Most people, without even thinking about it, adjust their attitude when they go to a funeral. We adjust our attitude when we go to a birthday party. A little bit. The kind of little change that goes on. Maybe it's almost innate to make the kind of shift. Can we shift our attitude a little bit so we have an attitude that's more conducive to walking this path? And so the suggestion is, change your attitude a little bit. Maybe just a little bit. Don't try to be insincere about it, but can you do some change? And one of the changes in attitude is, can you start being a little bit kinder? Try it. The second is, can you be a little more compassionate, less harsh, less judgmental? And the third is, can you avoid being driven or prioritizing sensual desire? Don't let sensual desire be the primary thing, attitude that's going to drive your orientation in this life. And instead, can you have an orientation of being kind of letting go, of being simpler? You know, kind of some kind of a movement towards simplicity of being. So first is an understanding the Four Noble Truths. The second is a little shift of attitude. And as the practice goes along, that attitude can shift a bit more and more. And then the third, fourth, and fifth steps of the Eightfold Path have to do with our behavior. And the suggestion here is that it's easier to adjust or take care of or look at our behavior than it is to adjust our mind. Our mind, you know, some deep way. Our mind is much more subtle. So the first thing to do is look at your speech. It's helpful if you're going to be on the path to liberation, path to freedom. It's helpful if your speech is not compulsive. And chances are, when people gossip, when people lie, when people use harsh language, chances are there's compulsivity that's built into that. If you can let go of that kind of language and rather talk in ways that are kind and honest and kind, then you begin shifting the inner territory. You begin understanding better what's going on. And one of the ways of understanding is that when you make a choice not to act in habitual ways, like I always lie, right? So I'm going to try not to lie. And so that's what my decision. And so then I find myself about to make a lie. Well, I can't lie. I said I wouldn't. And then I get to look at that. I get a little uncomfortable. I get to look at that and see what's really going on here in that lying. If I have free rein to lie as much as I want, then I don't get to look at it. So the right speech is considered part of the training. It's a practice. It's not meant to be an ethical thing, a moral thing. It's meant to be, if you're interested in this process of liberation, then speech is part of that process. And look at your speech and try to find ways to speak that express freedom. And the same thing for your other behavior. So for generally the next one has to do with your actions in the world, and usually described as your, here has to use the ethical life. So don't kill, don't steal, don't involve in sexual misconduct, don't lie, and don't intoxicate your mind and body. All things that usually when people engage in those things represent some kind of compulsivity, some kind of loss of, I would say loss of self-control. And then the fifth one, the Eightfold Path, is right livelihood. Many people spend much of their work, their daytime hours, pursuing or engaged in livelihood issues. And it's nice if that big chunk of our life is in harmony with a spiritual path rather than at odds with it. So giving some care to what our livelihood is an important part of the path. And then the last three elements of the path have to do with the inner life. And beginning to cultivate an inner life that is helpful for us. So avoiding those inner impulses which are harmful to us, cultivating and enhancing and awakening those impulses, desires, those wishes that are helpful for us. Practicing mindfulness practice, the core practice here at IMC, practicing mindfulness, so we can really see clearly what's going on. Without clearly seeing, you can't really get down into the roots. You can't really take responsibility for yourself unless you clearly see. And so mindfulness has a lot to do with cultivating the ability to see really well, see really clearly what's going on here. And to support the mindfulness of clearly seeing, the last of the Eightfold Path is right concentration. And right concentration supports the mindfulness by getting the mind still enough and focused enough that the mindfulness can then penetrate and see right down to the bottom of the mud and really clarify and uproot the roots so the lotus can be set free, I guess, or something. So the Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path are intimately linked. And as truths, these are not meant to be philosophical truths or doctrines. They're meant to be pragmatic truths. They're truths that are true in your realizing them. So they're not something you're supposed to believe in at all costs, but rather they're supposed to be something that you test and engage in and utilize in your life. And in utilizing your life, you find that they're true for yourself. So they're true, and they're realized, that's why they're true, rather than they're true because they're logical or something, or taught by the Buddha. So the pragmatic truths that each of us are to realize for ourselves. And the way to realize them is to engage as much of our life as we can on the path, to walk the path to liberation. And so I hope that as you go about this next year, that when you have an occasion to encounter sickness, old age, and death, you remember what the abbot did to the new monks. He took them on a holy pilgrimage to visit the sacred sites and to realize that when you're encountering these things, that there is something very important and special that goes on in that encounter. And there's an opportunity there. And the opportunity to discover the Four Noble Truths. And I believe that to do that well, if you do that well, you'll discover that in the midst of that open-blossomed lotus, as the lotus blossom opens, you'll find a jewel. And it's called the jewel in the lotus in Buddhism. And that jewel in the middle of the lotus is compassion. And that compassion is our offering back to the world. So we make a difference. So your encounter with sickness, old age, and death is a sacred encounter. Encounter that well. Something inside of you will open to find peace and freedom. And in that freedom, you'll have a jewel to share with others. For this coming year, May your compassion be a benefit for everyone that you encounter. Thank you.